Welcome, Susan Ball, and welcome to the third and final edition of our Providers Deliver podcast mini-series, looking at trusts that are trailblazing progress on the 10-year health plan. These are trusts that are making real headway towards delivering the big vision of shifting care from hospital to community, treatment to prevention, and analogue to digital. In this podcast, you'll hear from NHS Providers Chief Executive Daniel Elcles on some of the barriers standing in the way of the 10-year health plan and what needs to be done to ensure that the vision of the plan is realised. But first, let's look at mental health and the amazing transformational work going on at Tees, Esk and Weir Valley's NHS Foundation Trust, where, through a range of local initiatives, they've managed to reduce referrals into secondary care by 20%. I asked the Group Medical Director for Durham Tees Valley, Dr. Ranjit Shah, what lay behind their success.
This all started with the Community Transformation Initiative by NHS England. We weren't part of the pilot site, but we picked up this project in 2021. And as part of the project, the first thing we wanted to do was get feedback from patients, carers who were using the service at the time, along with stakeholders. And across Durham Tees Valley, we cover a population of nearly 1.4 million. Tees Valley around 700,000, 800,000. And for Tees Valley, we worked with Health Watch and wanted to really get feedback from patients, carers. There were around 900 patients and carers who contributed to the feedback. Feedback was brutal, but we needed to hear it. A system was broken. Patients had to wait weeks and months to get access to mental health services. And even if they did, in the crudest way, I can describe it, we would probably say you're still not unwell enough. So there were lots of barriers, and we would tell patients, you don't fit the criteria for secondary mental health. We are going to triage you, you'll have to go somewhere else. And we actually never closed the loop. So we didn't know if the patients eventually reached where we had referred them in the first instance. And overall patient experience was very poor. There were long waiting lists, and it just didn't work. Once we had that, we also needed to look at our own outcomes at the time. And so we looked at how many patients were being referred in, and then what was the outcome of that. And it was the same as per the narrative. Nearly 70% of our patients were either referred back, referred somewhere else, or sent back to the GP. 30% roughly patients got access to secondary mental health services. And that's appalling. If you think of it, it's kind of a disease model that we were working on, i.e. barriers, not getting access to mental health services, and you need to become really unwell before you get access. And we really wanted to turn that on its head. And for that, we worked with patients, carers, our partners, voluntary care sector, local authority, GP colleagues, and we did a week-long workshop in Middlesbrough football stadium. Actually, one of our PCN clinical directors at the time came along for that entire 1 week. And what we wanted to do was be bold and think about the patients and not kind of worry about how many referrals are going to come through. And the only way to do that was to front load our mental health offer within primary care. And once we kind of got the principles, we then worked with stakeholders to kind of design our model as to what that would look like. We now have band 7 mental health nurse prescribers established within all PCN, i.e. primary care network services across Durham and Tees Valley. Now, what that means is you've got a front-end mental health offer, prescribers who can actually address our patients' needs right the first time when they come to the GP surgery. There's something about loss to follow-up as well that it's important to highlight, because many a times services will say, oh, the patient got referred, but eventually they didn't engage. And my counter to that is, but the patient went somewhere the first time. They went to their GP, they went somewhere, they asked for help. Is it really us that has created so many barriers that over this whole service line, the patients get lost to follow up because they probably get fed up about coming back again and again or repeating their story? So we've now got nurse prescribers within GP surgeries. In the second year, we got mental health well-being practitioners established within GP surgeries. And along with that, what we also did was we thought there's something around physical health monitoring for our patients as well. And our patients are on complex antipsychotic medications sometimes. Our medications don't help and patients get metabolic syndromes, obesity, diabetes, all of those things. And unfortunately, some patients get lost to follow-up between ourselves and the GPs. So we have now banned four physical health practitioners who are established across secondary mental health services or mental health services and primary care. And their whole role is to pick up patients who are lost to follow-up, do an assertive outreach kind of model, follow those patients up, make sure we can bring them back for their blood checkups, for their ECGs, and we can, you know, we know it's a remarkable improvement in not just the mental health of our patients, but also their physical health. Now, what that means from a patient experience point of view is, say, for example, in 2024, around 40,000 appointments were offered in primary care by our nurse practitioners, and only 2.5% patients needed to be referred into mental health services. That's phenomenal. You know, you're getting it right the first time. You're making sure that as soon as someone comes to the GP surgery, that offer of mental health is present. And I think we can actually do much more. But that's where we are. It's also important to mention that we still probably get it wrong. I'm not going to say that this is a 100% model gold standard. We're getting it right all of the time. I'm sure there are times when we don't get it right. But the important thing is we've now got those trusting relationships with our partners. We've got huddles with our partners every week. And that huddle means that there is an open line of communication between us, local authority, voluntary care sector, primary care workers, and we discuss live patients and make sure that there are no barriers with regards to patients accessing mental health services.
Thank you so much. That's absolutely fascinating. And you mentioned there some of the brutal feedback about how you acted on it, but also some of the barriers that you had overcome as a trust. And like towards the end, you were talking about the barriers in terms of engaging and working, but with local authorities, voluntary sector organisations and GPs. I'm sure there'll be other trusts out there listening to this and think, yeah, we've got exactly the same challenges. So what did you do to tackle that specifically?
Listen and be humble. And we had to do that quite a lot. Our relationships with some of the organizations were not great. We all were working in silos. And what we came with an offer was, let's put all of that aside and think about the patients that we serve. This is not about us or them, but this is about the local population. And that needs to trump everything else. So what can we do together for our patients? Money isn't enough. There are lots of problems. But if we can make sure that pathways are smooth, clear, then we are on a winner. It wasn't easy. It's not as simple as that. We've had hundreds of meetings with partners. Sometimes they wouldn't even sit across the table and speak with us, but they are our best allies now. And I think it's the investment in time and repairing those relationships and going back again and again, those relationships and going back again. And, you know, this is for the local population and it's not about us, them, or anybody else. So it took a good year and a half to establish it. And actually, I remember when I went back and spoke with some of our staff and said, this is the model. And they said, oh, it's very simplistic. And I said, well, then it's a winner. If you think it's a simplistic model, that's exactly what we want it to be. Mm. Because at the moment, the model is very complex and people don't know who to go to, how to access services. So it's been a hard slog, but I think it's absolutely been worth it.
I was really interested because I know that you've been doing some work in terms of your tiered support approach through Get Help and Get More Help. Can you tell us more about that?
Sure. So that's based on the iThrive model, and we happened to understand that children's services had already cracked some of this and we wanted to learn from them. But from an adult mental health and functional older people's service point of view, we realized that everything was on the right, i.e. within secondary mental health services, and the offer at the level of primary care or at voluntary care sector was very minimal. For example, we had a single point of access team. Per locality, you would have two and a half members of staff and some medical input into it before this model. What we've done now is we've got a fully fledged community hub team with its own medical input, nurses, psychologists, occupational therapists, care navigators, all at the level of primary care, working very closely with partners. And if you have a brick and mortar physical health actual building in that locality, then patients could just walk in. If you were there, say in Hartlepool, you wouldn't even know that someone is accessing mental health services because it's literally a center where someone can walk in, but you've got partners around the table who can just pick up and answer any queries, or in the virtual space, have those kind of discussions. I think it's important to highlight because many people will think that finances are tight and we don't have the facilities of having a building in our locality, so we may never be able to achieve this. Not all our localities have a hub and mortar building, and that's fine. What's important is, do you have those kind of relationships where no matter whether you have a building or not, can you have those discussions in the virtual space and prevent patients from being passed from pillar to post?
Absolutely fascinating. And you were saying earlier also that the model that you've now introduced has reduced referrals to secondary care mental health services by up to 20%, even as kind of demand is increasing. So how have you seen that kind of play out on the ground with patients? Like, what impact has that had for patients, but also for staff as well? Because it's obviously changed completely how you work and how you interact with patients.
Yes. So as you would expect, post-COVID, all services have seen a massive increase in the amount of referrals that are coming to them. And what our data actually suggests is year on year, we've seen a reduction in the caseload rise for our services. So from 1,830, I think last year the rise was 163 or something like that. Now that is because we front loaded our offer. That's the only way to do this. And we should be doing more. The shift has to be on the left. We need to think about prevention and not a disease model where we keep kind of protecting secondary mental health services. So I think we need to even do more with regards to what we can offer at the front end. What that has meant is access to secondary services, if patients need to, either to the hub team or the treatment and intervention team, is much quicker. So our waiting times in most of our teams is now 2 to 3 weeks. The national target is 4 weeks. Some of our teams have probably a waiting time of 5 weeks, but even that is because they might have some staffing issues. And once that's resolved, I'm confident that we can go back to a 2 to 3 week waiting time. What that means for GPs is it actually allows them to see other patients. Because we are now helping them with regards to the mental health offer at primary care. So overall, it's just not for us, but also our partners. It just means that there is much more on offer. And I think we need to celebrate what the voluntary care sector brings to the table. I was a full-time consultant in Hartlepool at the time, and I hardly knew about what the voluntary care sector had to offer. And that's a shame, because then people like me were guilty of either prescribing or sending someone for primary care psychological therapies without really knowing the local assets and what was on offer. Whereas now, I'm pretty confident that anybody in any of our community teams has a really good knowledge, either via care navigators or the peer support workers or the lived experience forums in that locality, to make sure that patients get access to the right care and help. At times, what has happened also in the past is thresholds for risk assessments or the ability for certain organizations to work with patients will vary depending on their expertise in mental health. What we are now trying to say is, if we are the experts, then we should be able to hold and manage those risks. But what that then does, it allows voluntary care sector or primary care psychological therapy services to actually do the work. So overall, it's a win-win for everybody. And then patient experience obviously has improved. We've done some video diaries pre and post transformation, and the feedback is really good. Again, you know, it's not 100% all of the time, and we possibly get it wrong, but we've got lived experience forums now firmly established in every locality. We have regular meetings with Health Watch. I regularly meet with PCN, a primary care network clinical directors. And so if there is an issue, we can pick it up straight away. And I think that's the strength of this, that we've now got really strong relationships with our partners, irrespective of any trivial small problems that might happen all along the system.
So you mentioned that there's more you'd like to offer at the front end. In your dream world, what would that look like?
So I think we are lucky that the government has now started talk about 24/7 mental health hubs, neighborhood health centers, and I think from a mental health service point of view, we definitely have a role to play. Very early days, but literally last week, I've had a discussion with our colleagues in the acute hospital, and I just heard someone talk about obesity and how it's a pandemic and epidemic within the Northeast, especially. We've got a huge problem, and that it's a disease and more needs to be done. And I have already had a chat with some of our exec colleagues, and we've already set up a meeting for next month where I'm going to meet with them, our secondary colleagues, along with public health consultants, and start thinking, what is it that we could do? Because I'm sure there's something within the schools that could be done. There's something within the local communities that we should be doing, because we know the burden of all of this, if you just think of the disease model, is huge, and not just on us, but also the acute hospitals. So there's so much we could be doing. And I think we just need to think about, sometimes people have talked about what's the core offer. And my counter to that is, whatever your core offer is, if you want to protect your core offer, then you've got to let go of something and you have to shift left and you've got to help more in the prevention agenda. And I think that's everybody's responsibility. So that's my take. And I think we should be doing more.
So just to wrap up, if you had to give some advice to another trust that was looking to kind of replicate your model or kind of shape a model for services in their patch, what would be your top three bits of advice?
So I've done a lot of work with several trusts more recently across the country. And one of the things that everyone has tried to implement this model. Many have struggled. And I think because they've tried to use the same resources, but within the gift of secondary mental health services. So you're still kind of pushing everybody in one direction. And so my advice would be that you start thinking just the opposite and you start front loading your mental health offer in primary care. You spend a lot of time in developing those strong relationships with your local partners, because once you do that, then half the battle is done and you're on a kind of winning pathway. So everything needs to be front loaded rather than ring fence and protect your own workforce. There isn't enough money, but you also have to be innovative then about the roles. Can you have care navigators? Can you have peer support workers? Can you have pharmacy technicians? Could your pharmacists be prescribers? Not just the standard nurses, doctors, therapists, occupational therapists, because that's the standard model. Whereas now we just have to be much more bolder with regards to what is on offer in the community.
Dr. Ranjit Shah there on some truly impressive mental health work in the Northeast. That's the fifth and final case study in this mini-series of trusts that are trailblazers in bringing to life the big aspirations of the 10-year health plan. It's been so encouraging to hear about the progress being made in such a variety of settings. But no one can be under any illusion. Transformation on this scale is hugely challenging. There are plenty of obstacles in the way. I asked Daniel Elkeles what he thought were the main blockers to the successful delivery of the 10-year health plan.
So the biggest barrier is quite self-evident, which is the operational and financial pressures in the here and now are absolutely massive. And they do consume just about the whole of everyone's attention and ability to get stuff done. So you crowd out the need to plan for the future because you're so worried about the present. And what we've got to get right is it's not a choice of not do the present, but do the future or vice versa. We've got to do both. And we've got to make the shifts to prevention, community and digital feel like they're actually business as usual. And doing that enables you to do the stuff that we're being asked to do now. And if we can pull that off, then you can do both things.
But those financial and operational pressures that you mentioned aren't going away, are they? So how do we work around them?
So they're really not going away. And I think everyone will be thinking, gosh, not only is it not going away, it actually feels like it's getting more and more intense and more pressured. So what we have to work out is how do you use the shifts to actually help in the here and now make those pressures less intense? And in the places in particular who are, I've seen really focus on the neighbourhood stuff, you can see pretty quick results in how it reduces demand and saves money in their parts of the NHS. There was a great conversation with an acute trust chief exec at the last chairs and chief execs meeting, where she said, I just told my organisation we have to close two wards, and with the money I've saved from those two wards, I've given half of it to invest in community services so that we can actually have a different service model, and it's worked. And it's that kind of brave decision, or is it brave? Good decision, that enables us to make the shifts and deliver on the operational and financial performance.
So the next time you speak to national NHS leaders and you had to make a pitch for on behalf of NHS trust leaders about what they need to basically seal the deal on the NHS 10-year plan, what would you ask them for?
I would ask them for, please don't give us a detailed set of checklists about how to do every last bit of service change, because you won't get it right. The power that you can wield is to get the levers of change right. And in the 10-year plan, the biggest levers that are set out are the new contracts, the changes to the financial flows, and the changes to regulation. So you really need to focus on getting those levers to be incentivized in a way that enables people to deliver the changes they want to make to care models as easily as possible.
Daniel there, rounding off the Providers Deliver podcast mini-series on trailblazing trusts for the 10-year health plan. Remember, you can find summaries of the work highlighted in this series on the NHS Providers website, nhsproviders.org, where of course you can also see much, much more analysis and comment on the 10-year health plan and what's needed to ensure it delivers on its ambitions. A reminder as always too, that you can join in the conversation and subscribe to the podcast by following us on X at NHS Providers and LinkedIn with the hashtag The Provider Podcast. Thanks for listening.